Good morning, everybody. Now, again, I'm not always so used to using this microphone, so if I'm too loud or not loud enough, just let me know, and I will adjust accordingly. Okay, so just, again, in case there's anyone who wasn't here last week, just to introduce myself, I'm Rabbi Yossi Golden, Rabbi Shmuel Golden's son. My parents are in America for the summer, visiting family, so I have the privilege to teach in my father's place and to learn with you these weeks. And what we started to do last week was we started what I call a four-part series. We're going to basically, this week, and the next couple of weeks, focus more, not as much on Parsha, but more on what's going on now, the time period that we're in, the time period of the 3 weeks, the 9 days, leading up to Tisha B'Av, and even focusing right after Tisha B'Av on the concept of Nechama, of Nachamu, because I feel like sometimes these times are harder to connect to and not always taught enough. Because you know, no one likes being sad. No one likes entering a period of mourning. But at the same time, it's a very, very important part of the Jewish calendar. And I think that the more that we learn about it, the more we can hopefully connect to it. And that's why I feel it's important for us to spend this time really focusing on this time period. What we saw last week was we kind of took a big picture at the models that Chazal had created for relating to the Beit HaMikdash and relating to the concept of mourning, how we're supposed to commemorate, how we're supposed to mourn the Beit HaMikdash, the destruction of Beit HaMikdash. Just to quickly review what we saw, that there were four models, four different ways that Chazal had set up for us to properly commemorate the Beit HaMikdash. One was called Zecher L'Churban, where the number of things that Chazal command us that we should do in memory of the destruction, because of the destruction, memory of the destruction. We talked about putting the ash on the head of the chatan during the wedding. We talked about leaving an area of your home, an amah of your home, that people will leave unfinished, again, in commemoration of the korban. Other things that were mentioned were women not adorning themselves with all of their jewelry, or we also talked about people who are making a fancy meal should leave a certain amount out. That was what those are the examples the Gemara had mentioned. The second category was called not Zecher L'Chorban, not commemorating the destruction, but Zecher L'Mikdash, commemorating what was, commemorating the beauty and the greatness of what was. And we noted that those two very often go hand in hand, that sometimes whenever you're dealing with any kind of tragedy, the two ways very often that the big debate of how to refer to that tragedy is to find the balance between these two things. On the one hand, you want to make sure that you're commemorating the destruction. You want to commemorate what happened, but you also want to commemorate Zecher L'Mikdash. Remember what was. Remember the greatness of what was. We noted two examples: what's how to relate to the Holocaust. Do you relate to the destruction, or do you relate to the beauty and the communities that were? Okay. And we also noticed Rabbi Lam had a beautiful essay talking about two different ways to commemorate 9/11, the tragedy of 9/11. One was to leave that area destructed, totally the area of the Twin Towers totally destroyed in commemoration of what happened. Or in contrast, the other approach was no, build something great to remember what was. The third model that we talked about as a way of commemorating wasn't just to remember what was and be excited about what was in hoping to rebuild, was something we called anticipation of the future, where we don't just hope that the Beit HaMikdash will be rebuilt, but that there are very, very few halachot where Chazal command us not just to hope for the Beit HaMikdash, but to expect it to happen. We talked about how there was one specific halacha regarding when to be able to eat the Korban Omer, where the rabbis instituted that we eat it in a certain way, not just because we hope the Beit HaMikdash will be rebuilt, but because we expect it to be rebuilt very, very shortly. And then the fourth model, just finishing up what we did last week, because we're going to kind of key into this week, the fourth model we said was what we called not just relating to the past and relating to the future, but mourning, M-O-U, mourning the present. And that's the period of time that we really find ourselves in. Okay? Mourning the present means that there are certain times of the year where we need to not just commemorate, but to really actively mourn, to take more actions, to be much more active in what we're doing, much more active in the way that we talk about and mourn the Beit HaMikdash, the lack of a Beit HaMikdash. And there are really two categories of how we do that. There are two ways that Chazal have established that we're supposed to mourn the Beit HaMikdash. Okay? The first one we mentioned at the very end of last week's class, was the concept of kriya. Kriya refers to the halakha of tearing. Now, usually in classic Jewish literature, kriya occurs in a personal mourning. When a person has a relative, a close relative that passes away, there's something called kriya. There's a mitzvah, there's a command that the person is supposed to tear part of their garment in response to that sudden, and horrific loss that they encounter. What we saw last week was that, unusually, this commandment of kriya also exists not just in a personal loss, but also in the loss on the Beit HaMikdash. The halakha is that a person goes to the area of Makom HaMikdash. Now again, talk to your local Orthodox rabbi regarding when, how, and in what circumstances this should be done. But the general halakha is a person should, if they go and they haven't been there in a long time, usually a month is the amount of time, but that person should then, if a person goes and sees the Makom HaMikdash, which is still not rebuilt, unfortunately, and sees that, a person should tear kriya. And what we asked was, why? Meaning, usually kriya, tearing kriya, is a momentary visceral reaction to loss. A person loses a very close relative. The kriya is meant to be an expression of that intense sense of loss. How is it then, when we're talking about the Beit HaMikdash, which happened, the destruction happened thousands of years ago, why would Chazal command us to tear kriya? It happened so long ago. This, in addition, adding on to that, the other element of what we call mourning the present isn't just the tear kriya, but is the period of time that we're in now, the 3 weeks. The 3 weeks now, as we've started the 3 weeks, we accept upon ourselves certain types of mourning. We don't listen to music. There's no weddings. We don't go to different smachot, certain trips, pleasure trips we hold ourselves back from. And as we approach the 9 days, we're going to intensify that mourning even more. We're going to not shower as often, or take less pleasurable types of showers, not go swimming, not fly, but there are many different types of actions that are going to intensify from Rosh Chodesh and on. And then, of course, the height of the Avelut occurs on Tisha B'Av itself, where there are many even more intense types of mourning that we do. Now, the question can be asked again, which is, those actions that we're doing, they very much mirror, in many ways, personal Avelut, personal mourning, where a person who's during the 7 days of mourning doesn't shower, tears their clothing, doesn't do certain actions, again, refrains from pleasurable activities. So again, but those are usually done in response to an intense feeling of loss. A person loses a relative. This is how you react. This is how you express yourself. Soloveitchik famously used to say that there are certain actions of Avilut that are meant to represent emotion. Okay, the actions, the mitzvot that we do, the things that a person does during their time of Avilut, it's not just simply actions that they do, but they're meant to express the emotion. A person has emotion, doesn't know how to express it. The way what Chazal did in their brilliance was give a person ways to express that emotion by not taking a haircut, by not showering, by wearing clothes that are a little bit more shorn. In this way, by sitting on a lower chair. In this way, a person is giving expression, practical expression to the inner emotion, because not everyone might know how to express that emotion. But the question becomes, if that's what we're doing, a person does during personal Avelut, it makes a lot of sense. But why all of a sudden is a person going to be doing that now during the Beit HaMikdash? This is an event, this isn't a visceral reaction to anything that happened. The Beit HaMikdash was destroyed 2,000 years ago. Why would Chazal command us to go through this process of mourning on something that we don't even know about? We can't even, unfortunately, relate to. So what we saw last week, and this is the end of that, really keying into what we're doing today, we saw two suggestions for that. One suggestion we made was that sometimes there are certain losses, there are certain things that a person loses that span generations. And that when it comes to a personal loss, sure, that usually a person takes certain actions only when that loss is immediate. But when we're talking about the Beit HaMikdash, which represents our connection to God, our the unifying element of our nation, and our reality has shifted in so many dramatic ways, so that is mourned throughout generations. That every year we need to take time and almost re-energize or re-experience that feeling of mourning, because the loss is so, so great. And therefore we have to have it every single year. And the second suggestion we made was off of the famous Gemara Yerushalmi that points out that every generation that the Beit HaMikdash is not rebuilt, it's as if it was destroyed. Because really, what are we doing? Why are we mourning now? Why are we going through this act of mourning, of intense sadness? Because you're right. It was destroyed 2,000 years ago. But every single year we have that potential to have it rebuilt. And if it's not rebuilt, what we're mourning is not what happened 2,000 years ago. We're mourning the fact that right now in 2021, it's still not here. The reason it's still not here is because of the actions that we've done and the things that we have not yet done. And therefore, the mourning, the avelut that we're going through is meant to be intense, is meant to signify immediate loss, because it's meant to teach us there is an immediate loss here. We have that potential. We have that ability. We should have a Beit HaMikdash if we were acting in the way that we should. And therefore, it really is an immediate loss. It should feel like immediate loss. And that's what Chazal are trying to encourage us to do, during this time period, really feel that loss, really feel the lack of the Beit HaMikdash. What's interesting, and this is a famous idea that Rav Soloveitchik, the Rav, points out very, very beautifully. He says that, you know, we mentioned just now how what we do during the 3 weeks and the 9 days very much mirrors the action, the type of avilut that a person goes through in what we call their personal avilut. Okay. In fact, just to help us with certain terms, the Gemara in Yuma refers to personal avilut as what's called avilut chadasha. Avilut chadasha means new avilut, because it's avilut that happens constant. It happens, unfortunately, throughout many of our lives. It's what we would call new avilut because it's still occurring in our lives. When we talk about avilut for the Beit HaMikdash, the term that's used in the Gemara is avilut yishana, old avilut. Because since it's avilut, that's something that occurred many, many, many years ago. Therefore, it's referred to in the Gemara as avilut yishana. And these two categories, avilut chadasha, new avilut on a new loss, versus avilut yishana, mourning for something that happened, mourning for the Beit HaMikdash, are very important phrases, and the Gemara discusses in many different ways. And Rav Soloveitchik points out that even though the way we act for avilut yishana, for the Beit HaMikdash, parallels the avilut that we have, the avilut chadasha for personal avilut, it actually isn't just parallel, it's actually a parallel opposite. What do I mean? Says Rav Soloveitchik, the way that it works, the process that we go through during these 3 weeks is actually the opposite, parallel opposite of how a person goes through avilut in their own personal lives. For example, when a person suffers a horrible loss, a loss of a loved one, and they go through avilut, the avilut begins most intensely, and then it gets lighter over time. In the very, very beginning, both in the way it's felt and in the way it's expressed in halacha. In halacha, the halachot, the most intense halachot of restriction apply right after the person passes away. Even before avilut starts, there's something called aninut. Aninut is that period of time between when the relative passes away and the avilut hasn't even started, and a person isn't even supposed to do mitzvot. It's the most intense time of avilut, of mourning, because a person is meant to be involved with the mate, with the deceased, and is not even chayiv in certain mitzvot. And then the first day of avilut is the most severe. Then we have the period called Shiva. And during Shiva, there are numerous prohibitions. A person shouldn't shower or shouldn't take a pleasurable shower. A person should wear the same clothing. A person should be sitting on the floor. Shouldn't talk about anything besides for really the person, the deceased, and the loved one. After Shiva, after those 7 days, the person then transitions into a period called Shloshim. And during Shloshim, it usually lessens. Okay, and we'll talk just for our case, we'll talk about, let's say, a person who loses a parent. That's the easiest one to discuss. Okay, during Shloshim, a person shouldn't get a haircut. A person obviously certainly shouldn't go to any weddings. There are certain, even, I believe there's a discussion about not taking, even then, maybe not taking certain pleasurable showers. A person should certainly shower during Shloshim. No one's telling you not shower for 30 days. But again, there are certain restrictions maybe in how that is done, different minhagim and different halachot. But it's lessened from Shiva, but there still is an intense period of mourning. And then after Shloshim, we have what's called Yud Bet Chodesh is for 12 months, where a person still keeps the restrictions, but they're much, much less. Usually refers to not going to certain smachot, maybe not listening to music. Again, keeping the restriction as a way of mourning, but it started most intensely and then it gets less. What we do during the 3 weeks is the parallel opposite. What do we do? During the 3 weeks, our introductory period to Avilut mostly mirrors the 12-month period, where we don't listen to music, we don't go to weddings, we don't get a haircut. That's what a person generally will do during Shana. Then, after the 3 weeks, we get to the 9 days. And during the nine days most mirror the Shiva, where the restrictions become a little bit more serious. We don't shower unless we need to. There are certain, we're not going to go swimming. There are definitely certain things that we're not going to do. And then as we get to Tisha B'Av itself, Tisha B'Av itself most mirrors the first day of Avilut, even in some level Aninut. We're on Tisha B'Av, for example, Tisha B'Av morning. Men don't wear tefillin in the morning. They only wear tefillin in the afternoon. They're foregoing that mitzvah, holding off on a certain mitzvah until the afternoon. We don't learn Torah on Tisha B'Av unless it's connected to things that are connected to Tisha B'Av. So what happens is whereas during the Avilut Chadasha, personal Avilut, a person starts with it, it starts intensely and then it starts to get lower. Here we do the opposite. We start more leniently and then it moves up and intensifies more and more over time. So says Rav Soloveitchik, why? Why is it that Avilut Yishana, the old Avilut from Beit HaMikdash, is the opposite? And he explains very beautifully that we have to understand the nature of these two Aviluts. And if we understand the nature of these two types of mourning, we can much better understand why the order is the opposite when it comes to the 3 weeks. He says, when it comes to a personal avilut, nothing starts until the event happens. You don't know what's going to happen. Nothing's going to happen. There's no warning. There's no plan time, right? And we all know the Gemara says that one of the three keys that God still keeps to himself is when is a person going to pass away. Doctors can guess that. Doctors can estimate. But no one ever knows until that moment occurs. And therefore, and yet when that moment occurs, it's the most powerful and painful moment that's going to be. And therefore, it's natural that the second a person dies, that's when the most intense avilut is going to be, the most intense halakhot are going to apply, because a person's emotional state is the most intense. And then as time goes on, it doesn't mean that the deceased becomes forgotten, but as the nature of things is that things tend to get a little bit less intense. And therefore, the halachot of Avilut mirror a person's state of mind where it starts most intensely, gets less intense, and then less intense, and then less intense. Says Rav Soloveitchik, when it comes to the 3 weeks and it comes to Tisha B'Av, it's the exact opposite. It's not a visceral reaction to an immediate or horrific thing that happened. It's something that happened many, many years ago. And we have to train ourselves to get to that point. We have to prepare for it. We have to create that state of mind, as opposed to a personal reaction, which happens automatically. Here, it's something that has to be cultivated. And therefore, we start with a less type of Avilut in order to kind of get into the mood, and slowly, slowly need to build up to Tisha B'Av itself, where we hope to get into that state itself. And because of the nature of the morning, the way that it is manifested halakhically is opposite. Yes. Yes, true. That's something that I think is painful. And you know, and the tragedies have just been one after the other. 100%. And actually, one of the things we're going to talk about today is the concept that Tisha B'Av has become a day where we don't simply mourn the Beit HaMikdash, but it actually has become a catch-all, if you will, of mourning all types of tragedies that have befallen the Jewish people. And in that sense, you're 100% right. You're 100% right that there's a certain built-in sense of how things have happened. And you're right. And we hope that as we get through this period, that maybe God will listen to our tefillot and that we'll move towards much happier times. But you are correct that it is ironic that this year, that state of mind requires less to be able to cultivate that state of mind. Yes. I'm going to repeat your point. I'm sorry, what's your name? Sonia. So Sonia points out that another interesting difference between the two might be that when it comes to personal Avilut Chadasha, it's a much more of an emotional reaction to what's occurred. And the halacha is just giving expression to that. Whereas when it comes to the Beit HaMikdash or Avilut Yishana, it's much more of an intellectual exercise of reminding ourselves. I agree with you. The only point that I would add is that I think that there is an element of what we're hoping to create with Tisha B'Av that is also meant to create the emotional piece. Meaning, yes, correct, thank you. So the intellectual process is meant to cultivate that emotion. Because there is a concept on Tisha B'Av that is mentioned in the halacha of crying. There is a concept of crying, of bechi, on Tisha B'Av that doesn't really show itself in other places. Dating all the way back to the first Tisha B'Av, which is the Chet HaMeraglim, the sin of the spies. And the Gemara says that you cried, atem b'chitam b'chiyah shel chinam, that you cried tears of waste, because as the Jewish people cried because they didn't want to go into the Jewish land, into the Eretz Yisrael for no reason, that God says Tisha B'Av will always be that day of crying. But you're 100% right that it starts in an intellectual way, and it needs to be created and it needs to be manifested. Yes, correct. That's a very, very good question. Not only is there no fasting, But there's in personal avelut. The question that was asked, for those of you who are online, the question was asked, and it's another interesting thing, but difference between the personal avelut and the communal avelut is that personal avelut has no concept of fasting. In the Tisha B'Av, we do have the concept of fasting. Not only that, not only is there not a mitzvah to fast, there's even a halacha, something called havra'ah, sudat havra'ah. There's a special idea that when the person comes back from the cemetery, that somebody should prepare the food, that they should prepare it themselves, that somebody should prepare it for them. But is this concept of eating? It's an excellent, excellent question. I think it touches upon something a little bit different, and without getting into too much of the details, that Tisha B'Av is a very multifaceted day. Okay, Tisha B'Av is a day of mourning, but it's also a day of fasting. Meaning Tisha B'Av, on the one hand, is part of a series of fasts, like Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, like Asara B'Tevit, and the other ones, and some of the other ones, Tzom Gedaliah as well. Tisha Tanis Esther maybe is a little bit of a different. And Tisha B'Av has elements of both, meaning that whereas general Avelut is usually understood to be a time where you just sit, where you just kind of sit with the reality, and you talk about the reality, and you deal with the reality, whereas fast days inherently are meant to be days where you don't just sit with the reality, you also try to use the fast day as an opportunity to spur change, to spur thought, okay? The Rambam talks about this famously, where he says that all fast days are meant to be days where we basically, be darkei hatshuva. There are concept elements of tshuva, which is why Yom Kippur, by the way, is the same idea. We have a concept of tshuva, and we also fast. Now, why that doesn't exist in personal life, that is a good question. I think it could simply be, there's a practical factor to this. The person is going through so much immense pain, and we want to make sure that they stay. I'm just guessing that there's an element of wanting them to make sure that they're healthy. The fasting piece could mitigate that. But in addition, that's not what avelut is. That avelut is meant to be. That avelut is meant to be a moment of just simply talking about the mate, dealing with the mate, and focusing on the mate. It's not as much about let's move forward. Whereas Tisha B'Av, because of what we're mourning about, it's not simply about sitting in that state of mourning and avilut, but it's also about using this as a way to grow. I would point out, though, and this, I just thought of this now, it is interesting that even within personal avilut, many people have the minhag. What do they do on a yortzeit? There are many people that fast on a yortzeit. So maybe that's a way of bringing it in at a different moment in time, whereas during the avilut it might not be as relevant. But on the yard side, many people have the minhag to fast, of, let's say, a yard side of a parent or things like that, maybe to bring that element in. What I wanted to do now, after kind of giving us a background of understanding this type of avilut that we're now in, the category that we called mourning the present, is I wanted to deal with really a separate question. And that is the question that I think really is not really raised. At least I hadn't really known about this until I had heard it from a shiur, which is the question of when was the Beit HaMikdash really burnt? Most of us assume, and I think this is the simplest understanding, is that the 9th of Av is when the Beit HaMikdash burnt down. But if we look at the sources and we look at the Gemara, the truth is that this is not so simple. And I think if we delve into this idea, there are actually some really, really beautiful lessons that can be gleaned from it. And it starts with this Gemara. The Gemara, it's source number 3, is a Mishnah and a Gemara in the Sechet Ta'anit. We'll read through this quickly together. I did bring the English for you as well, for those who prefer to read through the English, because this is one of our fundamental sources. But I'm going to read through the Hebrew with you. The Mishnah begins, B'tish'a be'av, on Tisha B'Av, Nigzar al Avotenu. There are 5 things that happened on Tisha B'Av. Okay, one was Nigzar al Avotenu, Shelo Yukantzu La'aretz, our forefathers were commanded that they're not going to enter Eretz Yisrael. V'charav habayit barishona, and the first Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. Uvashniya, and the second Beit HaMikdash was destroyed as well. V'nilkida Beitar, okay, the city of Beitar was captured, which is a totally different issue we're not going to focus on today. V'nechresha ha'ir, not only was it destroyed, but it was totally destroyed, that it was plowed, which is a symbol of total destruction. When you destroy something and then you plow over it, showing that you're totally getting rid of all remains. What the Gemara wants to what we're going to focus on is the part of the Gemara where it talks about, well, wait a second, is it really true? Or how do we know that the Beit HaMikdash was actually destroyed on Tisha B'Av? Says the Gemara the following. Charav habayit barishona. When would the first Beit? How do we know that the first Beit HaMikdash was destroyed on Tisha B'Av? Says the Gemara, Dichtiv, the Pasuk says, this is a Pasuk, I believe it's from Melachim Bet, Uvachodesh HaChamishi B'Shiv'a LaChodesh Hishnat Chais Reishana LaMelech Nevuchadnetzar Melech Bavel Ba Nevuzaradan Rav HaTabachim Avad Melech Bavel Yerushalayim VaYisrof Et Beit Hashem. In the fifth month, which is the month of Av, on the seventh of the month of Av, the 19th year of Nebuchadnezzar's rule, his captain or his general, Nebuzaradan, entered Yerushalayim, and he destroyed and he burnt the Beit HaMikdash. Okay, that's one pasuk. Next pasuk, Uvachodesh HaChamishi, the next pasuk, this is a pasuk from Yirmiyahu, Uvachodesh HaChamishi Be'esor LaChodesh, on the fifth month, on the 10th of the month, Kishnat Chais Reishana LaMelech Nebuchadnezzar, Melech Bavel, Ba Nevuzaradan Rav HaTabachim Amad Lifnei Melech Bavel Yerushalayim. The seventh and the fifth month, on the 10th of the month, Nevuzaradan entered and destroyed the Beit HaMikdash. Now the Gemara notes that there's a clear contradiction between these two pasukim. The first pasuk says that it happened on the 7th of the month. On the 7th of Av. The second pasuk notes that it happened on the 10th of Av. Ask the Gemara, Vitanya, we have a Braita. E.F. Sharlomar B'Shiva, you can say it happened on the 7th. Sharin Kvar Nemar B'Asar, because the second pasuk says it happened on the 10th. E.F. Sharlomar B'Asar, you can't say it happened on the 10th. Why? Sharin Kvar Nemar B'Shiva, right? This is great Gemara learning, right? Because you can't make up your mind. One pasuk says the 7th, one pasuk says the 10th. HaKetzad, so then what actually happened? Says the Gemara, B'Shiva Nichnesu Nachrim Leichal, on the 7th is when they initially entered the area of the Beit HaMikdash. And there they kind of took their time. Achlu, kilkilu, they desecrated it. They spent a few days inside the Beit HaMikdash. Bo, v'kuku bo shi'i, shmini, on the 7th and the 8th, uchi'i, and on the 9th, samuch l'chashicha, right before the end of the 9th day, hitzitu bo et ha'or. They lit the Beit HaMikdash on fire. V'haya dolek v'holech kol hayom kulo. And then it burnt and continued to burn pretty much the entire 10th day of the Beit, of the 10th day of Av. Shene Emar, as the Pasuk says, Oilanu kipana hayom, the day is coming to a close, ki inatu tzalalei erev. Okay, meaning that basically what happened was, when was the Beit HaMikdash lit on fire? The very end of the 9th day, and it burnt on the 10th day. The Hainu de Amar Rabbi Yochanan, says Rabbi Yochanan, makes a comment on this whole discussion. Ilmale hayiti had beoto ador. Had I been one of the chachamim who was in charge of establishing when to fast, lo kivativ ela ba'asiri. When would I have established it? I would have made it on the 10th. Why would he have made it on the 10th? Why would he have done the 10th? That's when it burnt, right? It burnt. Says Rabbi Yochanan, it was up to me. The fast should be on the 10th because that's when it really burnt. It started to get burnt on the 9th, but it actually burnt on the 10th. Because that's when the actual desecration happened. Most of it burnt on the 10th. V'Rabbanan asked the Gemara, okay, well, that seems to make a lot of sense. So what's the logic of the Rabbanan? Why did the Chachamim establish us to do it on the 9th? Itchalta dipur anusa adifa. Itchalta dipur anusa adifa means the beginning of the tragedy is a better time to commemorate. Okay, now we're going to need to understand that one, okay, because you know, Rabbi Yochanan seems to make a lot of sense. But that's the Gemara's point. The Gemara says right now, it's chalta de puranisa adifa, it's better to commemorate the beginning of the destruction. Then the Gemara asks, okay, that's just the first Beit HaMikdash. What about the second Beit HaMikdash? Uvashniya minalan. How do we know, where do we know that the second Beit HaMikdash was destroyed on Tisha B'Av as well? Detanya, we have a Braita. The Braita says, Migal Gilun Zichut Liyom Zakai Vichova Liyom Chayav. That what we do is we combine good things that they happen together in bundles, and bad things also seem to happen in bundles at the same time. Okay, now this is a very, very interesting answer by the Gemara. What the Gemara is basically saying here is there's no real source for exactly when the ninth. We don't have a historical source in Navi for when the second Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, like we do with the first. But rather, if we know it happened around the time of Av, and we're going to, therefore, the way things work in Judaism is that good things tend to come in bunches, and bad things tend to come in bunches. And therefore, if we know that the first Beit HaMikdash happened, it was destroyed on the 9th, the second Beit HaMikdash must also be destroyed on the night. Okay? Now that's also a very interesting answer of the Gemara. But what I'd like to try to focus on, oh, before we even get to that, there's another interesting Gemara that I think highlights this point as well, stresses the idea that the two Beit HaMikdash were on the same day. This is a Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, source number 4. Says the Gemara very beautifully. Okay, that this Gemara is now discussing all the other fast days. Discusses all the other fast days and when those fast days occur and how and when we fast them. The Amar Rav Chana Bar Bizna Amar Rabbi Shimon Chasida. Okay, my dichtiv. What does it mean when the pasuk says, "Ko Amar Hashem Tzivakot"? So says Hashem. Tzom Harivi'i, the fast of the fourth. The Tzom Hachamishi, the fast of the fifth. These are referring to months. There's the fast of the fourth month, the fast of the fifth month. V'tzom ha-shivi'i, the fast of the seventh month. V'tzom ha-asiri, the fast of the tenth month. Yeh le-beit Yehuda l'sasonu l'simcha. These fast days will ultimately become days of happiness. Says the Gemara, make up your mind. Kari lehu tzom, you're calling them a fast day. V'kari lehu sason v'simcha, and you're calling them days of happiness. Are they days of happiness or are they days of fast? Fast, by definition, is not a happy time. Make up your mind. Says the Gemara, and I skipped a little bit the technical stuff in the Gemara. Amara papa, Hachi ka'amar, this is what it means. Bizman sheyesh shalom, if there's peace, if it's a peaceful time, yeniyu l'sasonu l'simcha, then it'll be happy. Yesh shmad, if we have some kind of, we're being attacked, or there's some kind of intense, decrees against the Jews, then it's a tzom, then it should be a fast day. Ein shmad ve'ein shalom, if there's no shmad, if it's a time that's neutral, where there's no peace, but there's also no one who's persecuting us, ratzu misanin, ratzu, and then it'd be an optional fast. If it's a time when it's total persecution, everyone should fast on these fasts. If it's a time where it's neutral, it's not time of persecution, but it's not a time of complete peace, then it'll be an optional fast. Says the Gemara, wait a second. So therefore, what the point is that these fasts, Asara b'Tevet, Shivasar b'Tammuz, the Gemara seems to indicate, might at certain times be optional. Now, by the way, the Gemara then later says that we as a community accepted to fast those days as well. But says the Gemara, but then what about Tisha B'Av? If what we're saying is that the fast days during times of happiness or during times when there's peace can be optional, so then why is Tisha B'Av a fast that everyone has to fast? Ihachi Tisha B'Av Nami. Amar Rav Papa, Sha'ani Tisha B'Av, Ho'u V'Huchbila Bo Tzarot. Tisha B'Av is different, because Tisha B'Av has a double sadness. There were many things that happened that were tragic on Tisha B'Av, including the destruction of both Beit HaMikdash, the sin of the spies, Beitar, and because there were many different tragedies, therefore that fast day is not optional. That fast day we always fast, whereas the other fast days at certain times throughout our history were optional. This fast day is always going to be a fast day. Tosfot, right there, on the spot, asks a very important question. He says, wait a second. Tisha B'Av isn't the only fast day that has numerous tragedies that happen to it. The Mishnah list on Shivasar B'Tammuz, the 17th of Tammuz, also has numerous tragedies that happen, right? Says Tosfot, V'yom Shivasar B'Tammuz, in source number 5, Nami Ira Chamisha Dvarim. The Mishnah also lists 5 things that happened on Shivasar B'Tammuz. Why is it that only, why are you implying that only Tisha B'Av has numerous sad days? Answers Tosfot with something very, very fundamental. Aval Churban Beit HaMikdash Kipa Tufa. Now, even though Shivasar Beit HaMikdash also had a number of things that are bad, what Tisha B'Av has that's unique is the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. The destruction of the Beit HaMikdash is an overarching tragedy. And that tragedy, when we mourn that tragedy, there's no option. You can't, oh, well, it's a peaceful time right now. No. Beit HaMikdash, that we always mourn. Not only that, says Tosfot, he gives another answer. The Od Lo Dami L'Tisha B'Av, Ditzara Achat Huch B'Luvah. The one difference also about Tisha B'Av is that on Tisha B'Av, it was the same tragedy that occurred twice. It was a double, it was this meaning, whereas when it comes to Shivasar B'Tammuz, there were a bunch of different tragedies that happened on that day. And therefore, even though a bunch of them happened, it's still to the point where if there's a time where it's peaceful, maybe we don't have to fast. Tisha B'Av, when you have the same tragedy happening again and again, that day you always have to fast. Okay. So what we see clearly from these Gemarot is that Tisha B'Av has been designated as the day when we mourn the Beit HaMikdash. But yet, I think we still have to deal with the initial question that the Gemara, the other Gemara raised, which is, but it only happened at the very, very end of the ninth day. It only happened as was approaching. The 10th day seems to be the day that we should really mourn. And in fact, by the way, as many of us are familiar with, if you look at source number 6, there's a very important halacha that actually applies even nowadays, resulting from the fact that it burned on the 10th, which is, we still keep certain parts of Avilut even after Tisha B'Av ends, the night of Tisha B'Av, even on the 10th, until Chatzot, right? We don't do our laundry, there are many things we still don't do. Why? Why is it that we still keep it? Is it kind of like we don't want to rush into, so the answer is no, the answer is that the reason is because the 10th day is when the Beit HaMikdash was actually burning. Says the Shulchan Aruch in source number 6, says the Rav Yosef Cairo, B'tish'a be'av le'et erev, at night, hitzitu esh be'hechal. That's when they burnt the heichal. V'nisraf ad shkiat, and it continued burning until the end of the 10th. U'mipnei kach minhag kasher shelo lecho basar. We don't eat meat. V'lo lishtot yayin. We don't drink wine. Belel asiri uviyom asiri. Not to eat, drink meat, and drink wine. And also, many of us, we don't do laundry. There's certain right restrictions that we don't do until the next, even on the 10th. Notice the Shulchan Aruch, by the way, doesn't say up until Chatzot. He says all the whole day the 10th. The Ramah, which is what we Ashkenazim hold, adds right here, the Yesh Machmirim ad Chatzot Hayom v'lo yoter, that the Minhag is only until Chatzot. So what we see is that even practically we keep this idea that the Beit HaMikdash, that the 10th is a day of mourning. So getting back to our initial question, why don't we follow Rabbi Yochanan? Shouldn't the 10th day, the day when the actual structure, this Beit HaMikdash, which represents everything, the day that it actually burned, shouldn't that be the day when we actually mourn? Why are we mourning? What do Chazal really mean when they say Tchilat the Puranisa Adifa? That the beginning of the Puranus is really the most important time. Yes, Anisha. I think if I understand what you're at, you're asking why is it that after Chatzot and Tisha B'Av we start to lessen Avilut? It's an excellent question, and I'll even strengthen that question. To even strengthen the question, this might even be what you mean. We're learning right now that when on the ninth day did they actually start to burn the Beit HaMikdash? The second half of the day, which is the part of the day that we all of a sudden have the minhag to start lessening our avilut. Meaning, ironically, it seems to be very, very, it's a great question. I want you to hold off on that question. We're going to get to that in a future class. It's an excellent, excellent question. And it very much ties into the connection of where nechama and what the concept of nechama and comfort comes from. Because what does it mean that on Tisha B'Av we start to feel that nechama already a little bit and then continue with it? It's an excellent, excellent question. And it's strengthened by exactly what we're saying, which is if the ninth is when it got lit, that seems to be the time when it should be the most intense. Excellent question. Hold that. Okay. I'd like to explore two suggestions for this question. Okay. Again, to remember our question. Our question is basically, how do we understand this? The Beit HaMikdash, if someone asks you when did the Beit HaMikdash burn, really, it burnt on the 10th. And yet our minhag is to fast on the 9th. And Rabbi Yochanan himself said, no, if it was up to me, it would be on the 10th. And yet the Gemara concludes, Tchilat de Puranuta Adifa, the beginning of the Puranut is better. And what I want to understand is why. If anything, you know, I would think the time when we're seeing it up in flames should be the most dramatic time that it would happen. And I would like to explore two answers to this question that I believe both have very, very powerful messages for us. The first idea, the first answer that I heard is by Rabbi J.J. Schachter, who is a senior scholar of the Center for the Jewish Future in Yeshiva University. And he every year, and I don't know if any of you have ever tuned in, but he gives a shiur for Yeshiva University every year on Tisha B'Av. Throughout the day, talking about the keynote and giving shiurim. And one year he spoke about this very question of why we commemorate the 10th as opposed to the 9th. He made the following suggestion. We noted earlier that Tisha B'Av, we don't just commemorate the actual tragedy itself, the tragedy that happened on Tisha B'Av. But what has happened over time is that Tisha B'Av has become this catch-all where on that day we commemorate and we mourn all tragedies that have occurred throughout Jewish history. And in fact, this idea is not new. If you look in source number eight is Rashi. Rashi is commenting on a pasuk in Divrei HaYamim. I'm not going to go through the pasuk right now, but it's basically just a pasuk describing Yirmiyahu wailing about Yoshiyahu, without getting into the details of that, of who they are and that. But Rashi points out right here, this is the earliest source of this concept, Kishem mizdamein lahem shum tza'ar ubichia. When anybody has any kind of tsa'ar, any kind of, pain and crying, shehem mikonenim uvochim al ha'me'ora, Hey maskirim ze hatzar imo. Dugma b'tishah be'av shemaskirim kinot al harugim. But very often, when a person is crying about something, he also mentions other things that happened. And says Rashi, this is similar to what we do on Tisha B'Av. Because on Tisha B'Av, says Rashi, our minog isn't just to mention the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. It's also to mention all types of death and all types of persecution that have happened over the course of the Jewish history. And if we think about it, if we think about the keynote that we read on Tisha B'Av, especially even in modern day now, we don't just read about what happened. We also have about the pogrom. We have keynote about the Holocaust. We have keynote about the Crusades. We have keynote where basically we are mourning and crying about everything, about all the different tragedies that have befallen the Jewish people. And I would even add that, you know, even the tragedies that have happened recently to us today, where we can mourn particularly everything that's happened. Says Rav Schechter, Rav J.J. Schechter, perhaps if we look at Tisha B'Av as this day, which is not just about the destruction of Beit HaMikdash, it is about that, but it's also this time where we basically recognize that Tisha B'Av was the entry to basically tons of Jewish persecution and tons of Jewish destruction. And if we look at Tisha B'Av as this starting point, as this beginning, where from then we've become much more vulnerable to everything that has happened throughout the generations, then the key and the most important point is when it all started. It's not the actual burning. It's the point. If we were just mourning the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, says J.J. Schechter, if we were just focusing on the Beit HaMikdash and that was all we mourned, then you're right, maybe the 10th would have made sense because that was when the actual structure burnt. But what is Tisha B'Av for us? It's not just a day where we mourn for the destruction. It's a day where we mourn a reality, a new reality that came to the Jewish people, a new reality that befell the Jewish people, which is with the beginning of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. The Jewish people entered a time when they are now subject to all types of persecution throughout their lives. And we commemorate that on Tisha B'Av. And if that's what we're commemorating, we're not just commemorating the moment itself, we're commemorating the beginning of this new reality, which we unfortunately still find ourselves 2,000 years later, says from J.J. Schechter, then that moment, the most important moment is going to be the beginning, the first moment that it happened, because that moment represents the beginning of a new reality with which we are still living today. And therefore, if we have to decide to start on the 10th or to start on the 9th, when the Gemara means Chila de Puranusa Adifa, the beginning of the Puranut is more appropriate, it's saying that Tisha B'Av is not just about this destruction, it's about destruction, and it's about a new reality being introduced to Chazal or to the Jewish people. And that started the beginning of the destruction of Beit HaMikdash. And therefore, we suggest the Rav Schechter, that's why we start on the 9th. That's answer number one. Suggestion number one. I'd like to share with you another idea. And this idea I heard, I guess, you know, as a graduate of Yeshiva University, I get to make a plug for a couple of their wonderful staff. So this I heard from Mori Rabbi, my rabbi, by Michal Rosenzweig, one of the Rosh Yeshiva in Yeshiva University, in a really beautiful shir that he gave also about Tisha B'Av. And he suggests the following point. He says that Avelut Yishana, the mourning for the Beit HaMikdash, is not as much about the burning of the actual structure as much as it's about the root causes of what made it happen. Meaning, what are we really mourning? Are we mourning the building, or are we mourning God's decree that it should happen? Or, even more so, our actions which initiated God's decree? Okay, and I was thinking about this yesterday when I was thinking about finishing, putting the final touches on this year, and I was thinking about like what kind of mashal, the lahavdil, the one mashal that I can give, which I think helps to highlight this point. Lahavdil, again, very different. You think about a car accident. Okay? A car accident usually results from some kind of mistake. It could be a mistake of a driver, could be a passenger, it could be a faulty something in the engine. Okay, and when you have investigators or forensics who are trying to determine what happened, what moment do they care about? Do they care about the point of impact? Usually, again, the point of impact, chas v'sholem, is a horrible thing, and we don't want it. But what are the investigators and the forensic experts looking for? They're looking for that moment when everything shifted. What was that moment that made this car, chas v'sholem, get out of control, which ultimately led to what happened? Was it maybe a faulty part of the car, in which case the car makers might be in charge? Was it somebody on their phone? Was somebody playing with the radio? What was that moment during which everything shifted? Now, the ultimate destruction is sad, and of course we care about that, but the investigators, what they care about is what was that moment during the process of this person driving where everything shifted, and now he put himself on some kind of never-ending, you know, collision, no pun intended, course for what was going to happen. What they care about more than anything else is the moment where everything shifted, not as much about the destruction itself. So Lahavdil, getting back to our example, says Rav Rosenzweig, what we're mourning, what we're sad about, is not as much the building itself. The building itself, once God decreed that the Beit HaMikdash was going to be destroyed, the building was just wood. It was just stones. It lost its holiness. What we're mourning is the moment where God decreed this is going to happen. And not only what God decreed, but where we acted in a way that caused God to decree that this is going to happen. And therefore, if we had to pick the time that we should be mourning, that we should be sad, it's not the 10th when we see the building up in flames. Of course, that's sad. Of course, that's tragic. But what's more sad is what we did the time leading up to that, perhaps on the 8th, on the 9th, or the weeks and months leading up to that. And for that, the most appropriate time is going to be right before and right at the time when that starts, when it gets lit. Because we're mourning the reality that God is allowing this to happen. And I want to just to highlight this beautiful point. There are a number of different ways we can highlight this, but there's a really, really fascinating medrash or argument in the midrash regarding Megillah of Eicha. Okay, and the Megillah of Eicha is the Megillah that we read on Tisha B'Av. And if you look at source number 9, it quotes a very interesting, almost confusing medrash. The medrash says as follows: it's a machlokes as to when Megillah of Eicha was written and when it was stated, when it was given, when the nevuah was given. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Bimei Yehoyakim Nimra, Amar Rabbi Yechiyav. Oh, so what does that mean? Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Bimei Yehoyakim. Yehoyakim, just to give a quick short history lesson, Yehoyakim was an evil king of the kingdom of Yehuda. After the Jewish kingdom had split into two, there was the kingdom of Yehuda, the kingdom of Israel. This is towards the end of the first Beit HaMikdash. And Yehoyakim was one of the evil kings. During that time, Yirmiyahu, I brought the story for you in source number 10. We're not going to go through it, but basically, God tells Yirmiyahu, I want you to write the following words down. And he writes these words down. He says, I want you to bring it to the people. And he brings it to the people. The Jewish people, they start to see, and they see what they've done wrong, and they start to get sad. And it gets all the way up to the king, Yehoyakim. And it's read in front of Yehoyakim. And Yehoyakim looks at this, and he's an evil, horrible king. And his reaction is, once it gets to the fifth verse, he takes a knife, and he cuts out the names of God in the Eicha and throws it into the fire. Okay. So it's a horrible, horrible event that happened. Then God tells them to go into hiding. Yirmiyahu goes into hiding, and Baruch, who is his assistant, goes into hiding. And God then tells Yirmiyahu to write this, it's called a Sefer, write the Sefer again. Now, according to, this all happened 20 years before the destruction. Okay, this is about 20, 30 years before the destruction of Beit HaMikdash. According to the first opinion, Rabbi Yehuda says, when was Megillat Eicha written? During the days of Yehoyakim, which means it was written 20 years before the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. As says Rav Rechia, in this medrash, V'chibochin al hamet ad shelo yamut. Wait a second. How could you tell me that Eicha is going to be written 20 years before the destruction? Do you cry about something that's only going to happen 20 years later? Does a person mourn the death of somebody who hasn't yet died? Of course not. Maybe it was originally written in the days of Yehoyakim, but it was only stated after the Churban. Why? Because what is Eicha all about? Talking about destruction, talking about sadness. It's talking about everything. So it says Rav Rechia, there's no way it could have been said and given before the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, because it doesn't make any sense. It's about the destruction. What's this month? And in fact, by the way, if you look in sources number 11 and 12, we're not going to see them inside, but this question of when Eicha was written is a machloket amongst all the commentaries. Rashi and most of the commentaries believe that Eicha was written 20 years earlier, before the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, whereas the Ibn Ezra believes that it was written after the destruction. But it gets back to our question, how could it be, as Rav Rechia asked, how could you be giving the Megillah of Eicha? How could Eicha be written and said and the Nevuah be given before the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash? It hasn't been destroyed yet. You don't cry about a mace before it dies. says or suggests, Rav Rosenzweig, perhaps we can understand it a little bit better if we understand what we've been saying until now. Because what we're crying about, what we're mourning about, is not the actual destruction itself. It's the events leading up to the destruction. It's the decree that God made, and it's our actions that brought that about. That happened and occurred and started decades before. And what we're mourning, and therefore to mourn about that reality, to mourn about how we've been acting, how the Jewish people were acting, and to mourn about the fact that God could decree this to happen, that could be done before the actual destruction takes place. And therefore, that way we can understand Rabbi Yehuda's opinion that maybe Eicha could be written and even said years before the destruction, because we're mourning, what Eicha is lamenting is not just simply what the actual physical destruction, but is the events leading up to that destruction, which itself are more sad for us and are more unfortunate. This also highlights for us, well, we'll just take a few more minutes. I want to just make this beautiful Gemara, and then we'll close. The Gemara actually hints at this concept, hints at the idea that the real tragedy wasn't the actual destruction, the actual burning, but the events leading up to it. Which Gemara does this? This is Gemara in source number 13. Source number 13 is describing the actual, this is a Gemara in Sanhedrin that describes the actual destruction. It talks about Nebuzaradan. Nebuzaradan, as we mentioned earlier, Nebuzaradan was the general of the Babylonian army, and he was the one who was entrusted by King Nebuchadnezzar to go and destroy the Beit HaMikdash. And the Gemara describes in detail what he did. We're going to see a small portion of it. Says the Gemara, Adlik Beinura, he lit things on fire. Okay, he lit the Beit HaMikdash on fire. We're coming in the middle of the story. Gava Hechala. And then, says the Gemara, he even tried to jump up and enter Shamayim. According to Gemara, the heavens were almost open because of everything that had been happening. And he even tried to come up and to try to enter the heavens and attack the heavens. Says the Gemara, Darchu Bei Min Shamayim. They pushed him down. The heavens pushed him down. Sheneemar dagat derech Hashem libitula bat Yehuda. That they pushed him down. We'll leave that passage for now for the side. Kazeh hadaite. He was very proud of himself. This Nebuzaradan, again, we're coming in the middle of the story, but he just basically had committed horrible acts in the Beit HaMikdash. And he was pretty proud of the fact that, look, I'm all that. I'm good. I just destroyed the Beit HaMikdash. Nafka bat kola v'amrale. The bat kol comes out of Shemayim and tells him the following. It says, Nebuzaradan, you think you're so good? Ama katila katal. You just killed a nation that's already dead. Hechala kalya kalit. You just burnt the hechal, a Beit HaMikdash, a building that's already been burnt. Kimcha tachina tachint. You're in the middle of harvesting wheat that's already been harvested, it's already been produced. What is that batko basically saying? The batko is basically saying, you think you've done anything? This nation is already dead. This Beit HaMikdash is already burnt. That's what the Bat Kol said to him. Now, what does this mean? And many of them, unfortunately, what does that mean? What does it mean that you killed a dead nation? You burnt a burnt Heichal? What could it mean in terms of, once we understand what we've been saying? Any ideas? See, exactly. Look at what Rashi says. Rashi, right here on the spot, says, what does Amakatila say? What does it mean that you killed a dead nation? Shekvar nigzar alehem alka. God had already decreed that they're going to die. And what's the turning point? What's the key point, says this Gemara? Not when he lit it on fire, but God's decree that it was going to be lit on fire. Not when they actually die, but God's decree that they're going to die. Why? Because the key moment is not the actual burning. It's when God decrees that it's going to happen, and our actions leading up to it that cause that decree. There are a number of many different sources that we can continue with this idea. Source number 14 and 15 is Chassam Sofer says this, the Nefesh HaChayim, and Rav Chaim Volozhin says this as well. But I want to just close with one important point. Just to remember what we saw today, we focused this last part of our shiur on the question of why we specifically fast on the 9th of Tisha B'Av, if the 10th is when the Beit HaMikdash really burnt. The 10th is when things really happened. And in fact, the Gemara debates this. Rabbi Yochanan himself says, if it was up to me, it would be on the 10th. Well, so why do we mourn on the 4th? The Gemara says, Tchila de Puranusa Adifa, the beginning of the Puranus is a better time. So we asked, why is that? Why do we pass in that way? So one suggestion, we quoted the name of Rabbi Rabbi J.J. Schachter from Yeshiva University, where he suggested that if we look at Tisha B'Av in a much more global scale, it's not simply about mourning just the Beit HaMikdash, but it's really mourning a new reality that came into the world, this reality where we are now under persecution, which has continued for thousands of years. And one of the proofs to that is that on Tisha B'Av, we don't just talk about the Beit HaMikdash, we talk about all the tragedies that have happened. If we look at that, then the key moment is not just going to be when the actual Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, but when the moment when everything changed. And that happened what the beginning of the Beit HaMikdash, once the Beit HaMikdash was first lit on fire. That was answer number one. Answer number two, we quoted the name of Rabbi Michal Rosenzweig. Also, it's mentioned by Chassam Sofer and a few other people, which is we have to understand what we're mourning. What we're not mourning is, we're not mourning the actual physical destruction of the building. We're mourning the underlying issues. The underlying issues, the root causes. And that is, number one, we're mourning the moment that God made the decision, this has to happen. We're mourning our actions leading up to that, for years leading up to what happened. And if that's what we're mourning, then it's most appropriate that it should be done on the 9th of Av, those moments leading up to when it actually, right before it actually is burned, as opposed to the time when it is burnt itself. Now, if that's the case, then the onus is now more on us. Because if we're just mourning a building that burnt, so then it's sad, but okay, it's not here anymore. What are we supposed to do? But if the mourning that we're doing on Tisha B'Av is not the building itself, it's God's decree. It's the actions that we took to contribute to that, to cause that decree. So then the onus is on us, is that every single year to ask that same question. Why is that decree still here? Why is that decree still here? Getting back to what we had said earlier about how every single generation that the Beit HaMikdash is not destroyed, it's as if it's been burnt. It's as if it's been destroyed. It's because of that same idea, because we're not, the focus isn't on the building. It's on the root cause. It's on the actions. It's on our contribution. It's on what we've done to create this reality where God has decreed that the Beit HaMikdash to be destroyed. And the onus on us is to think about that and consider that as we enter this time period, and to really think about it and understand that the mourning that we're doing is so much about our action more than just a historical event that happened many, many years ago. Thank you, everybody, for joining. Wishing everybody a meaningful week.